This is producer David O'Leary with a quick reminder to our listeners. For the next few months in 2024, we will be releasing several remaining episodes featuring the late Richard McSpadden, including today's episode. We hope you enjoy this edition of There I Was.
I had just started fixed wing training with my new instructor. This was my third flight in, 3 hours total. We did some touch and goes in the pattern, did some pattern work, and on our fourth takeoff, we climbed out, full power, did the checklist, and as I'm turning crosswind at about 900, 950 feet MSL, which is about 700 feet off the ground here in Manassas. As I'm turning left crosswind, the engine made a boom sound and then sputtered out.
Welcome to another edition of There I Was, a podcast where we put you in the cockpit with pilots in demanding situations and we learn how they flew out of them. I'm your host, Richard McSpadden. Today's guest is student pilot Bradley Riedel. Bradley has about 50 hours as a student pilot. He kind of did it in reverse order of most people. He actually started with rotary training and then realized the expense and the length of that training and then transitioned to fixed wing flying. He's a flight ops coordinator for Chantilly Air, and today he's going to share a story with us about flying with his instructor before he soloed in a Piper Cherokee 140 when they experienced some engine problems. Bradley, welcome to the There I Was podcast.
Thanks for having me, Richard. It's a pleasure.
So this is interesting, not just from the standpoint of your engine failure, but what really got our attention was just the aftermath of that and how as a student pilot you come back to flying and the whole mental positioning of that kind of transition. So we're interested in your story, but we're also interested in that post-event element of it as well. So let's start with your story, Bradley. Tell us what happened.
So in November of 2022, I had just started fixed wing training with my new instructor, and this was my third flight in, 3 hours total. We went out at 5 p.m. due to my work schedule and started doing maneuvers in our practice area just west of Manassas. We came back, did some touch and goes in the pattern, did some pattern work, and on our fourth takeoff, we climbed out, full power, did the checklist, and as I'm turning crosswind at about 900-950 feet MSL, which is about 700 feet off the ground here in Manassas, we had an engine failure. And as I'm turning left crosswind, the engine made a boom sound and then sputtered out. Being 3 hours in, I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. I was clueless. So I handed the controls over to my instructor.
Well, talk to us about that. So you're turning crosswind, and it sounds like the engine just suddenly failed, which is unusual. Did the propeller completely stop? The engine just completely stopped and went quiet? Or what actually happened with the engine?
So the engine made that boom sound. It sputtered out, and you could see the propeller start feathering. It was definitely slowing down, started feathering. So as we were turning that crosswind in the engine field, he took the controls from me and, you know, informed me we had an engine failure. I was like, okay, that makes sense. That makes sense that that's what happened.
Okay. And just to be clear, feather is a very specific term with a propeller. Your propeller wasn't really feathering. What you're talking about is you saw it slowing in the wind. So you know there was no more engine power that was turning that propeller. It was just beginning to sort of windmill down, right?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, and so your instructor takes over the controls as an instructor would and should do. And then what happened?
So we were in the left turn from crosswind. He had the controls and he kept turning us back towards the runway. I've been told since then that's called the impossible turn to get it back onto the runway, especially since we were at 700 feet and we were below 1,000 feet.
Okay, yeah. So just as you're starting your turn to crosswind, you get this engine failure. So you're kind of in that impossible turn scenario. So what'd you guys decide to do?
Well, at this point, and this was the big deciding factor in this accident, was it was 6 o'clock at night that this happened. In November of 2022, sunset was 5. It was dark out. My instructor made a decision to turn back to the runway because continuing left, there's neighborhoods and residential areas. and there was no way we were making the fields to the right side of runway 16 at Manassas. So he made the decision to turn back towards the runway.
Okay. And so I think you mentioned you were about 700 feet or so. Interesting. So talk us through what happened. Did you actually make it back to the runway? Talk us through that turn back.
As he turned back to the runway, we were losing altitude fairly quickly. I'm a heavy set individual. We're super nose heavy, and we started dropping altitude fairly quickly. After about 15 seconds of him trying to get us back in line with the runway, he decided there's no way we're making a runway, and he saw the taxiway. So he aimed for the taxiway. At that point, air traffic control is calling out to us, asking what's going on, why we're coming in so low. And my instructor said we had an engine failure, and they asked if we needed, you know, help. And basically, we need help. Air traffic control was nice enough. They canceled everything, and then it was pretty quick. 15 to 20 seconds after that, we impacted the ground before the taxiway. There's a little bit of a berm off the asphalt on the departure side of runway 16, so near the run-up area for 3-4 right. And we hit the ground, and I just remember as we're coming in, it was pitch dark, like completely pitch dark. I had that feeling of, you know, your whole life flashing before your eyes. And we hit the ground, and I remember skidding, and I sat there for a second thinking, okay, I'm alive. I can breathe. And I was in immense pain. Mm. I've had a previous back injury when I was in the military, and the disc in my lower back was herniated when I was in the military. So I thought the disc in my back had been re-injured in the accident. I remember on impact and skidding, my head had kind of brushed the top of the airplane, and I slammed back down in my seat, even though my seatbelt was tightened. And I just sat there, and I realized, wow, I'm still breathing, and wow, my back hurts, so I'm obviously alive. And so at that point, I opened my eyes. My instructor's doing all the checklists, and I was like, okay, let me out of the airplane. And he's running his checklist, turning everything off, reached over to me, turned off the fuel, did his entire post-accident checklist to make sure there was no fire potential or anything like that. And after about the third time of me asking him to let me out, I was like, let me out of this airplane. And eventually he snapped out of his frenzy to turn everything off and finally let me out. My back was so in so much pain that I couldn't get upright. I crawled out onto the wing and eventually just rolled over onto the ground and the grass there. At that point, a King Air pilot who had his departure clearance canceled because of the accident was kind enough to shut down and run over and check on us and make sure we were okay. He got in the airplane, made sure that there was no fire potential because my instructor was kind of shaking and obviously and stressed. And then he checked on us, made sure I was okay. And ambulance showed up and finally took me to the hospital. And I had an L1 compression fracture that I had about a 5-month recovery time after that with physical therapy.
Wow, Bradley, what an ordeal. Let's go back a little bit. I want to clarify. Were you taking off of 16 right or 16 left?
16 left.
So you were on the long runway there. You get past departure, and it sounds like you start your turn across when maybe 700 feet or AGO when the engine quits, and your instructor continues the turn back aiming for the taxiway just because it's a shorter distance towards you rather than going all the way the runway and then having to, you know, sort of check turn back. Mm-hmm. But you don't make that either. You land short of the taxiway. By about how much would you estimate you were short of the taxiway?
To put it this way, when we skidded and finally came to a stop, we were just over the taxiway, right to the right of the run-up area for 3-4 right.
Okay.
So we were less than 150 feet away from the taxiway entrance.
Okay, yeah. I'm just following along here with you on my four-flight map using the aerial view. So I can see why at night there just weren't any good options. Your instructor makes the turn back, so he makes it inside the airfield boundary, which is good. But then what can also happen here is trying to stretch that glide, he hits somewhat hard coming down in. And then it sounds like the airplane stayed intact. The wheels stayed on, landing gear stayed on, so nothing like that collapsed or came apart.
No, negative. They, after a few days, the NTSB obviously was in contact with me and informed me they ended up finding the landing gear over 100 feet away and that the left wing was damaged. So the airplane is completely totaled.
Okay, so it did when you hit the gear, one of the landing gear came off and separated.
Yes, sir.
And one of the wings. So it was a pretty hard impact.
Yes, sir.
You know, this goes well. We'll pause on this a little bit to that whole turn back discussion. At night, looking at it, it was probably, you know, pretty dark out there in front of you and off to the left for your crosswind. You can see some houses out there, which I'm sure the instructor was worried about. And he probably felt his clearest airspace was back behind you. And either that or just his instinct. And that's what we have to watch as pilots, is that you take off, you have a problem, your instinct is going to be to run back home. You know, that fight or flight mechanism, your instinct's going to want to be to run back to where safety was. And so making that conscious decision is so difficult and so important for pilots and to premeditate it. You guys make the turn, you make a hard landing, and then the instructor's in there, and, you know, it's a balance, right? I can understand him wanting to get the things off to make sure all the electrical equipment's off and the plane is as safe as it can be. On the other hand, you guys also need to get going and get out of the airplane. So managing those tasks and doing it promptly and swiftly is pretty critical. And it sounds like, you know, you were just ready to get out, which you finally did.
Yes, I was definitely ready to get out. And at that point, my back was, it was very painful at that point.
Yeah, I can imagine. So did they ever determine what was the cause of the engine failure?
So I've been in contact with NTSB a few times over the past, 9 months now. And they haven't come out with a preliminary or a final report on the accident yet. And neither the NTSB or the FAA has informed me if they have any opinions on the matter of what caused the engine failure.
Wow, that's a heavy ordeal to go through as a student pilot. And just, I think you said your third sortie or in your third hour of fixed wing training. Let's first pick up your instructor. How's he doing since this accident? Is he back instructing? Did he have any injuries?
So my instructor had no injuries. He didn't even go to the hospital. He was completely fine. And he's currently my instructor still. I went back to him after the accident, after I had recovered and was cleared by my doctor to go back to flight training. I picked back up right where I left off with him.
Wow. Wow. You guys have been through the fire together. And did that strengthen your student-instructor relationship? Because you guys kind of know you've been through it. Or talk to us about that dynamic.
I think with any student-instructor relationship, there has to be a balance between friendship and the teacher-student role. My instructor has become a great friend to me, but he also knows where to push me to so that I get over the finish line. He knows how to push me to where I progress in my training, and I've come to value that a lot.
Being a pilot is about passion and dedication. The early mornings, hours invested, constantly learning procedures and details, there's a lot to do. Membership in AOPA makes doing the groundwork easier so you can get into the sky. With the power of thousands of pilots united behind you, get access to exclusive resources, practical benefits, and fierce advocacy that helps enhance and protect your freedom to fly. Join us. Visit AOPA.org/membership or give us a call at 800-872-2672.
So let's go back now and talk. How about now the aftermath of your accident? So you said you had to go through some physical therapy and some medical treatment. So how long between when the accident happened and when you returned to flying?
So the accident was November 21st, 2022, and I was in physical therapy up until the beginning of March of 2023.
Okay. So, you know, what is that, 4 months or so? And when you came out of physical therapy, I mean, I'm sure while you're in physical therapy, tell us the stages of mental preparation you went through. Like, did you first start, I'm never getting in an airplane again in my life kind of thing? Or did you always say from the start, man, I got to get back flying soon? Where were you mentally?
So I try to have a positive attitude, and after getting my degree in aeronautics and being in this industry, I knew I had to get back in the airplane immediately. I mean, I'm sitting in a hospital bed and my significant other, her name's Lily, was telling me, you better not go back into that airplane. And I was like, well, Lily, statistically, I'm about set for the rest of my career, you know.
Good way to look at it, yeah.
Statistically, how many pilots do you know to get into two crashes in their career? And she's like, well, that's because they're not stupid enough to get in another airplane after the first one.
Oh, man. No, that's really not the case. Yours is right. And the other thing to remember is this is what oftentimes gets lost. In general aviation, we fly about 25 million flight hours a year. And from what we can count, just the ones we can count, that's more than 30 million takeoffs and landings. So if you look at that statistically, in terms of the average GA pilot flies about 50 hours a year, our fatal accident rate is somewhere around 0.73 per 100,000 flight hours. Statistically, you can fly well over 2,000 years safely before you have to worry about us getting caught up statistically, right? So sometimes that gets missed. You know, we always hear about our accidents and our mishaps. What we don't hear about is the literally the tens of thousands of flights that go on in GA safely every single day.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things I had to work through with family and Lily, because they were all pressuring me to like, hey, stop this. You don't need to be flying. But I had to explain to them like, hey, I'm okay. I lived through it. I'm good. And this has become an experience where I've learned from it.
And yeah, I think many of us have had that conversation because there is this perception of people that general aviation is not safe. And it is safe. But I think many of us have had that conversation with people we love that say, look, this is meaningful to me. This is how I'm going to live my life. And I need you to accept that. Not only just accept it, but embrace it as a part of who I am, you know, part of what I want to do with my life. And, you know, typically the people that love you will, you know, kind of nod and accept that. So I want to talk about now. So once you got, but you made the decision, I've got to get back in and get back on the bicycle, so to speak. You get back in the airplane. How'd that feel mentally to you?
There was a few weeks beforehand where the preparation to get back in the airplane, even before my doctor released me, I had to sit down with my instructor. We did a safety brief to go over the accident, to go over and talk about what happened, what could have been better, what we could have done to prevent, you know, all of the preventative measures for the accident so that we can move forward in the training and avoid any unnecessary risk. We identified risk factors such as, you know, nighttime flying. If we had better visibility, then we could have maybe made a better decision for a landing spot. He and I decided that touch and goes during my student pilot training was an unnecessary risk because it foregoes going in depth on the checklist, the takeoff checklist, the potentially getting better a better understanding of fuel or visibility in general to make that go, no-go decision on the ground instead of doing a touch and go. So we went through all these pre-briefs before I finally got an airplane, and I told him, like, hey, I don't want this first flight back in to be maneuvers. I just want a point-to-point flight, almost like a discovery flight, just to get me back into being air without completely freaking out.
Mm-hmm. Confidence. You just needed a confidence builder, right? Let's walk before we run kind of thing.
Absolutely. And so eventually, we decided just to do a little trip down to Charlottesville, get some dinner. We met up with a couple of friends, got some dinner, and then flew back. But getting into the seat initially, taking off out of Manassas, we took off 3-4 right, and we're climbing out. And I was doing the radio calls. I'm comfortable with radio calls. I did that a lot through the military, so that was never an issue with my training. So I took off doing the radio calls, talking to Potomac Departure. And then as soon as I'm turning west to exit the CFRA, that left-hand turn, as I'm talking to Potomac Departure, just set something off. I looked at my instructor, and I'm in the middle of the turn. I'm like, take the controls. And my instructor, and this is one of the things I love about my instructor, because he'll question me. He's like, why? I was like, just take the controls. I need a minute. And then I physically saw him soften up and it's like, okay, I'll take the controls. You just look outside and take a breather. At that point, I was full blown anxiety, panic. It took about 15 minutes. We were well past Warrenton Airport at that point, still climbing. When I finally, had my breathing under control, my anxiety was, was smooth there, which thankfully, getting back in the airplane, I couldn't have asked for better weather. It wasn't bumpy or anything. I was still climbing, and I finally just looked back in the cockpit. My nerves were good. The view was beautiful. I was super calm at that point. I took back the controls and finished a flight out to Charlottesville.
So, Bradley, I want to ask you, did you have any indications before you flew that you might have this kind of panic attack? Anything? Were you feeling a little antsy about it before you went, or did this totally catch you off guard?
It really caught me off guard. I've done a lot of crazy stuff in my life. I used to rappel out of helicopters when I was in the military. Not a lot of things make me nervous. So when I was taking off and that hit, it was completely foreign to me.
You know what? That's kind of the point I was hoping to emphasize, because I was sort of getting that impression, is that for anybody who's been through any kind of trauma like that, you may think you're doing fine, but you can't really assess that until you get under a certain situation which may suddenly bring it all back to you. And now you have reactions that are unnatural to you, unknown to you. You've never had them before, and you're inside an airplane. So I'm so thankful that you were there with an instructor and that you guys could work through that. It was a relatively short period, but if we take maybe a pilot who was a full pilot at that time and could have flown solo, man, that would have been a bad idea and could have been a bad outcome.
Absolutely, I agree, because I don't think I've ever recalled a time in my life where I just shut down completely. And that's exactly what happened. And thankfully, since then, after getting back into the, finally getting back into the airplane and taking positive control of the situation after that, it hasn't come back to me. I've never had any anxiety or panic attacks after the fact. And even now, when I do my, solo cross country like I did yesterday in preparation for my check ride, I was completely calm. It was probably one of the most relaxed moments I've had in a while, just sitting in the airplane, flying, finding my VFR checkpoints and talking to, flight following and approach without anybody sitting in the cockpit with me. It was the most relaxed I've been in a long time.
Well, now being on the backside of this, what's nice for you is you've had the experience of one of the most critical situations a single engine piston pilot can deal with, and that is engine failure shortly after takeoff. You've been through that. You know what it's like. You know how to fly through it and decisions that you can make. And you've also been through a panic attack airborne. So you've kind of worked through that as well. So it's kind of the silver lining of this is you've had some very demanding mental experiences that most pilots only have to hope they're prepared for. So you have the confidence of going, I know how to deal with either one of these situations.
Yeah, absolutely. And after going through that, I think a few weeks after the fact, we were doing another maneuvering flight and coming back to Manassas. And as I landed, my right tire on my landing gear blew on me. I was with the instructor at that point too, but it completely just tore apart on landing. We almost went into a ditch off the side of 3-4 right. And something like that, it definitely shakes you up a little bit, but after experiencing an engine failure, something like that didn't even cause me any issues. It was like, oh, really? Like, really, this is my luck, We were able to get it off the runway and, put it over on the ramp and get it out of the way, and there was no issues with that. But like, this is my luck, isn't it?
So, Bradley, looking back on that, how would you coach pilots who've been through traumatic situation like you, whether it's an engine fire or some other kind of problem in the cockpit that shakes you up a little bit? What would your coaching be to them for not just the stick and rudder, the instructor, skills to get back in the cockpit, but the mental preparation?
What I would say is almost every pilot out there is a type A personality. If they want to pursue aviation, they have to get over that hump. And one of the biggest things that was good for me is that I work in this industry and I work with a bunch of professional pilots. The chief pilot that I work with here at Chantelier has been a great mentor for me in this industry. And I think having a mentor when you're going through this training that isn't your instructor, that can provide feedback, was beneficial for me to get over that hump, to get back into the airplane, even though my family really didn't want me to.
Yeah. So I'm thankful that some of the developments that we've seen lately is just the whole openness to talk about mental health issues and the ability for pilots and just the community at large to be able to talk about mental health issues and as a disease and not some kind of stigma, and how people can get help and the treatment they need. And we can have these open conversations to say, you know, it's not weakness or some other stigma that we used to associate with it. It's a serious issue that happens to people under certain circumstances, and sometimes it can be induced by stress. And so just our whole willingness in society, and especially in aviation, to take a look at and focus on mental health is an important aspect. So your story brings that out, and I thank you for sharing it with us.
I appreciate that. And I think when it comes to mental health and aviation, it's the FAA is working towards shedding more light on it so that people with these issues can come forward and not get their license taken away or get their medical taken away. And I've noticed this in the industry. And a lot of the industry is predominantly male. Males, especially alpha males, have a hard time admitting when they're not feeling okay. And thankfully, since I work around all these people and they've seen what I've gone through, they tell me, they've taught me that it's okay to feel things that are abnormal as a male and to express those things. I think if I hadn't looked at my instructor and told him, hey, I need a minute, then it would have just been another hole in the cheese model. Mm. And I think after the fact and having these mentors in my life and them telling me that it's okay to express myself when I'm not feeling okay was definitely beneficial when I got into the cockpit and I was able to say, hey, I am not okay right now. Like, take the controls. I'm not okay.
Well, you know what's helpful to the community at large is a person like you being willing to open up and tell their story to say that, look, if this guy that served in the Army and rappelled out of helicopters and did all these things can have this panic attack or anxiety, we're probably all susceptible to it. So I really appreciate you sharing your story.
Thanks, Richard. I appreciate that.
Well, there's an interesting situation for a student pilot at night, and it brought up a couple things, the whole turn back discussion, and we went through that and the considerations that are even exaggerated at night. And I thought Bradley and his instructor did a great job of getting together and determining on their own some lessons learned and how they would adapt. I love the expression that says, it's not a lesson learned until you change something. Until you change your behavior, it's just a lesson observed. And it sounds like they moved their situation from observing lessons to actually implementing them and learning from them. And then a very good discussion on the mental aspect of coming back after that kind of trauma in the cockpit where you lose an engine or something else, something we really shouldn't take lightly. I mean, here's a guy that's come out of the Army and done some pretty exciting and, quite frankly, dangerous things, more dangerous than aviation, and he comes back in, this first flight back, gets this anxiety kind of out of nowhere, something that we should all consider. And if we ever have a situation like that, to just step back and make sure we take the preparation mentally and take care of our emotions before we go in and start working stick and rudder issues. So we're so thankful that they did recover and his back recovered. We're wishing him the best on his check ride coming up soon. Thanks for joining us on this edition of There I Was. Alongside our producer, David O'Leary, I'm your host, Richard McSpadden. Fly safe.
Hey, this is producer David O'Leary with a note to our listeners. Bradley went on to earn his private pilot certificate a few weeks after we recorded this episode. We'd like to extend our sincere congratulations to Bradley, and we wish him well in his future pilot endeavors.
Hey, listeners, We want to thank you for making this one of the most popular aviation podcasts there is. Thanks to you, our listeners, for your engagement, for following us, and for your likes and subscribes on whether it's iTunes or Spotify. Those mean a lot to us and help us expand the aviation reach and our aviation safety message. If you'd like to help us and become a supporter of these podcasts, please consider a donation to the AOPA Foundation. That's aopafoundation.org. Thanks for your support and thanks for making this podcast so successful.
There I Was is produced by the AOPA Air Safety Institute. If you'd like to hear other episodes, submit comments, or submit your own story to potentially be featured on the show, please visit airsafetyinstitute.org/thereiwas. Thanks for listening.